Welcome to Worlds Apart. United we stand, divided we fall. This ethos, first articulated by Aesop, has been central to the evolution of the Western worldview, having been invoked in contexts as diverse as the Bible sermons and politician speeches. And while the West still cites unity as the bedrock of its international policy, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa have started to explore a different approach to unity, the one that does not require the sameness of values or uniformity of action. Can the world be reunited through divisions? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined from Pretoria by Mikatekiso Kubai, a research fellow at Institute for Pan-African Thought and Conversation. Mr. Kubai, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me. By the way, I'm also a researcher at the Institute for Global Dialogue associated with UNISA.
And I'm sure that expands your expertise, and that's why this conversation will be even more substantive. Now, I know that through both of these affiliations, you explore your academic interest in BRICS. And as I suggested in my introduction, the countries that make up this group, as well as those that are interested in joining it, have very different national identities. They have different forms of governance. They have different value systems. And yet somehow this group keeps rising in prominence, despite all those differences, divisions, distinctions, what have you. Given BRICS' lack of insistence on unity, what keeps it together?
BRICS came in to respond to a problem, you know, in the governance of the global economy, in the governance of the global financial architecture. And that, you know, agenda is still very much, you know, relevant, you know, today. You have to come together, significantly influential economies. Yes, they're all different economies. And each one of them, you know, brings in, you know, something quite unique, you know, to the collective. I must hasten also to add, you know, that, you know, there may be some, you know, differences, you know, in how, you know, particularly the Global South, you know, look at international cooperation and so on. It's not so much an issue of, okay, you know, this, you know, country has got a very powerful military, or this powerful, you know, say science, the capability. It's more about the potential of collective action, of like-minded countries on a particular issue. And you'll also notice that the countries, in BRICS, in fact, have had a challenge, with colonization. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of commonalities, that bring, the BRICS bloc together. Thank mm-hmm. you.
You mentioned the origin story, and I think it's pretty remarkable, because as far as I know, the first time this BRICS metaphor, this BRICS attribution was coined, it was actually proposed by a Goldman Sachs trader who essentially proposed it as a marketing ploy to sell the shares of developing countries. And slowly but surely, it then evolved into a viable organization, first through regular meetings of foreign ministers of those countries, and then through the summits of heads of state. So essentially, it was something that came out of a Western financial system and yet evolved into a distinct non-Western grouping. What do you think allowed for that movement to happen?
I would argue, that BRICS, does not come from Mr. Jim O'Neill. They came together. Remember, you are talking about states here that have to act in the interest of their citizens, the interest of their region. And so not, you know, on the ideas, you know, and the expectations, you know, of a scholar or intellectual at something time. You will recall when, in fact, round about the same time that the G20 was, you know, being formed, so came to be, you know, the BRICS, round about 2008, in response to global financial crisis, right? Now, that is not a gym or need, you know, that is countries coming together saying, you know, have, you know, by a strategic interest in what is happening. Some issues, some mistakes are made elsewhere, and the mistakes are impacting all of us. And, you know, we have a very big stake, in fact, you know, in what is happening. Our economies are growing. This crisis will lead to, you know, a major recession, and that is not good for our populations. That is not good for our development agenda. And they came together. The following year, South Africa also came to being because Africa, you know, is a major, you know, in the management. It's a major stakeholder. They were talking about a coming together, you know, of human beings, you know, different organizations, different histories, coming together to say, look, you know, we're sharing the world together and we have a common challenge as humanity, you know, not as, you know, a block of this one specific, but people from around the world.
Well, Mr. Kubai, let's just explore this thesis because, you know, you frame it as coming together of people from the entire world, but the world, if we are honest, has been divided into various tiers over the last couple of decades. And certainly, if we look at the global financial infrastructure, which I know is one of your interests, you know, it aspires to be global in its reach, but it's highly centralized in terms of accumulating power and accumulating benefits. And one could argue that one of the reasons why BRICS came about and one of the reasons why we have so many tensions and imbalances in the world is because some of the Western countries, if not the entire Western bloc, insisted on keeping its privileges only to itself. It speaks about, you know, serving the interests of humanity. But if you actually look at the way the global financial infrastructure is designed, it privileges one camp and not so much the other. Do you think this is something that is natural? It just happened historically? Or do you think it was designed that way specifically to encourage the development of some and hamper the development of others?
Well, there are a couple of things, you know, but in different areas. You look at, you know, the political dimension and another an economic dimension. I'll explain why, you know, I mentioned this. From an economic dimension, you know, you have to factor in the evolution of finance, financial technologies, and so on. BRICS came to fore, you know, as leading economies, you know, of one that was developing what you like. Right, that have something, you know, that, you know, many other developing economies do not currently have as yet. Coming together to say that collectively we can do something to influence the situation that is. Having, you know, inherited an economic system or a global economic system or a global financial architecture really that came to the fore. Just after the Second War, a relic, you know, by some view, we have, you know, that, you know, same reinforced, you know, reified all the time, every year. Yes, you know, it has led to many inequalities. Yes, it is democratic. Yes, you know, but, you know, it, you know, advantages some, you know, not others. You know, and BRICS from its inception recognized this and decided that, look, we have to do something. We have to try and achieve, you know, a more democratic governance of the global financial system, governance of the, you know, economy. We need to get, you know, more voices, democratize, you know, multilateralism. including the financial architecture.
If I may add something, and let me know if you disagree with that, I think that sort of drive has intensified with the start of the Russian operation in Ukraine and the introduction of very sweeping financial sanctions and trade sanctions against Russia, which came to hurt not only this country, but also many other countries. And I've heard many analysts suggest that with countries like Argentina, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Iran expressing their intention to join BRICS is truly becoming a platform that explores and tests ways of doing business, sort of circumventing the Western financial institutions and, you know, the strings that come attached with relying on those Western financial institutions. Do you agree with that? And do you think there are still venues to do business in the world circumventing the West?
On countries joining BRICS, BRICS, yes, is becoming popular. It is popular because of what it represents and what it's trying to achieve. Secondly, how it operates. BRICS operates on consensus, on shared and agreed, decisions. There is no one power as the biggest economy, in the BRICS bloc. But if a single BRICS country, that decides it does not like a particular position, then BRICS, one of BRICS does not move on that issue, does not take a decision. So it works, on consensus. That's a very attractive, feature, of the BRICS bloc. Mm-hmm. The second, development agenda. No country in the world, so no region in the world, wants to remain where it was 100 years ago. Every region in the world wants investment. Every region in the world wants development for its people. Mm-hmm. Every region in the world wants access, to affordable finance, to infrastructure, to invest in research and development, to capacity building, in the technology, the sciences, BRICS, the global rather than BRICS. Does not think according to, we need to circumvent this one, we need to circumvent that. It thinks, from the lens, it seeks to make an contribution and, to betterment, of the management of global affairs.
Mr. Kubai, I have to stop you for just a second because we need to take a very short break, but we will return to that subject in a few minutes. Stay tuned.
According to French President Emmanuel Macron, the continent must decide whether it wants to be free or a vassal of China or the United States. Macron has never been known to be an original thinker. However, on this point, he is obviously right. The real question is whether Europe still has the power to decide its fate at all.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Miktetekiso Kubai, a research fellow at Institute for Pan-African Thought and Conversation. Mr. Kubai, before the break, you mentioned this strong drive by developing economies to industrialize faster and in a more varied way to ensure safeguards against external shocks, be it the pandemic, the war, sanctions, what have you. Is it only about faster and more secure growth for you, or isn't it also about national selfhood, sort of not only the right to develop, but also the right to develop in your own way, to walk the road of progress at your own pace and in your own gait?
Quite often we like to describe it as agents, right? To act, by your own yes, represent your own country, represent your own region, represent your own people. In this way, possible. Yes, you cannot have the same geographically. Countries differ, economies differ. Socially, quite considerably. The nature of infrastructure and spend in each country, differ. So you also have development, that is different. There's different, amounts, in terms of investment needed for individual country. So each country has to, essentially fit the rest of the world, in its, undertakings. Mm-hmm. It has to look at, development under conditions, progress, in its own context, determine itself. Mm-hmm. Not determined by anybody else.
But Mr. Kubai, this is exactly what the concept of sovereignty refers to, doing things like aspiring to certain goals, but in your own way, sort of. We all come from different parts of the world, and it could be argued that we all appreciate similar things, but we access them differently. And I wonder if you have given any thought to how various countries can sort of cultivate this appreciation of local conditions in their own population, because sure, we all want to achieve certain pragmatic things or living standards, but we also deal with very significant soft power influence of the West, which comes with pushing its own values or own narratives or own interests on the other populations. And it's very easy to succumb to this temptation that, other nations' way of doing things is more attractive than yours, that, grass is always greener on the other side. Have you thought about how to sort of cultivate this appreciation of grassroots ways in people?
Some developments, African continent in particular, and I think this is starting to happen in other regions of the world, particularly the developed economies and so on. Firstly, you're seeing a slightly more assertive African Union. That says that, this is what, these are our conditions. This is what we live, will assist us to, meet, the challenges we're facing, and, the challenges and achieve, development and progress. Right? It's beginning to start, on internal matters. Right? We take sanctions on Zimbabwe. The African Union has got a position, on sanctions and does not agree, for instance, with unilateral sanctions on Zimbabwe. In fact, on anyone, but particularly on the African continent, to say that hang on, we should have the first say on what is happening on the continent. BRICS, on the other hand, has been talking about interventions in areas such as pharmaceuticals, interventions, infrastructure, as well. The establishment of the BRICS Development Bank, is precisely, to address, some of those questions on, better access, finance under better conditions, zero conditionalities, or as minimal, conditionality, so that you do not have a country how to run its affairs, but to focus on the project itself, make sure that the project is viable, make sure that the project actually benefits the people that it's meant to benefit. Yeah, no, not to tell you to reduce, you know, the size of your public service or restructure your economy in this one way or another. That is what BRICS is essentially trying to say, that look, we have to look at a different way of development, which is precisely what Africa, you know, is, you know, by engaging. That is why BRICS is particularly popular, you know, right now, precisely because non-interference, you know, in internal affairs, you know, by others. But, you know, we do have a shared responsibility as humanity, you know, to pursue development. And we can say that, oh, okay, one corner of the world, you know, remains, you know, most developed, the most affluent forever, you know, and others remain and languish in poverty, you know, under development forever. That just can't be.
Well, speaking of which, if I can ask you a somewhat philosophical question, but I'm a big fan of archetypal psychology, and I think fairness has an archetypal appeal, meaning that regardless of cultural differences, people have an innate sense of balance of give and take. And even though many Western countries, the most affluent countries, see themselves as the givers, I sense from my travels around the world and from my conversations with people around the world that, at least in part, this resistance associated with Western worldview has to do something with this somewhat exploitive attitude towards the rest of the world that you know, many affluent countries have practiced not only over decades but over centuries. What do you think about it? Do you think the West historically has given as much back as it has taken from the rest of the world?
Well, I'm not too sure what, you know, giving back is in the context, you know, of our experience here.
Has it been fair to the people where it operates, in countries where it operates?
I'll give you two examples, right? If you, for instance, consider the elite financial groups, a more recent, you know, an issue that's, you know, has received illicit financial flows for tens of billions, you know, leaving the continent every year, right, through illegal means. Money that could be, you know, spent on the continent, you know, to invest in infrastructure, to invest, you know, in development projects and so on. Now, what do we have instead, right? Now you have aid, you know, into the continent. Commitment, you know, of aid doesn't always come as aid. Sometimes it's just a commitment of aid, you know, that comes to the continent, and it comes also with conditions, right? That we bring, we give money, but our companies, you know, will be the ones that provide a particular product or a particular service. So in the end, the zero, extended benefit, you know, to, you know, the place, the target of that aid, you know, and so on. So in the context of the African experience, I'm not too sure, you know, what giving back by the West to Africa actually has been. Recently, you know, I attended, you know, a conference, you know, of the G20 think tanks. You know, and, you know, there's a real drive. I mean, this is not just African think tanks, you know, saying this. Even some European think tanks, you know, are saying that we have to start looking at the economy differently. We have to start looking, you know, development, you know, differently. We need a new development paradigm. What way in which we've been doing things in the past is simply not working for anybody. In fact, there are even challenges in Europe as we speak. So we have to start, you know, working as a collective, not a divided world, because that's simply not where. I mean, we learn from history, you know, that, you know, it's a divided world, you know, is not, you know, a healthy one.
So essentially what you're suggesting is an authentic philosophy of win-win, the idea that if you actually mistreat your neighbor, it will come back and hurt you. And I think this is what you mentioned, those Western economists, but it's well known that Africa's youth bulge could be an opportunity, but it could also be a major risk, not only to European economies if the migration is uncontrolled, but pretty much to the rest of the world, because everybody in the world wants a dignified life and wants, you know, good prospects in life. Can I ask you very, very fast, because we only have less than a minute, but you wrote a lot about this youth bulge and that it could actually be turned into a youth benefit, you know, something that could allow Africa to have faster than average growth rates. What are, you know, some of the things that you think needs to be done to allow for that conversion to happen rather than, you know, this youth bulge being a major security risk, turning it into a real youth benefit?
I think there are very important areas, and all of them are really financial, more than anything else. The first one is access to finance for infrastructure, because you need infrastructure to educate, you need infrastructure to move people around, you need infrastructure to allow people to innovate. Right? The second issue is investment. I need investment in the continent. Now you have a young population that is increasing, you know, middle class, that is educated, you know, that, you know, is savvy, tech savvy, you know, that isn't, and it's growing. I mean, if you consider that it will reach 2.5 billion in 7 years, that's a big population of jobs, you know, that will need. So the third area, localization, you know, of production, right? You mentioned earlier, one of the benefits of that is, you know, a cushion against, you know, global supply chain shocks, COVID pandemic, for all of that, you know, for all of us in a you know, detrimental way. Young people, you know, have an opportunity in their hands, educated young people available, you know, and they are willing, you know, to do their work, but they need the investment, they need access to finance, they need the infrastructure. So these are the areas where serious interventions, you know, can be made. But in the digital space, you know, the world works, you know, on ICTs, you know, by these days. Everything is online, everything is, you know, digital. You know, and so on. And young people are tech savvy, and, you know, they want the opportunity to innovate and, you know, pursue development. I think those are the areas that are urgent, you know, that can give better results for young people. Mm-hmm.
Well, Mr. Kubai, we have to leave it there. We are out of time, but I'm really grateful for this conversation. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for hosting.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.